I know there's still a little turmoil, but if we still want to have some chance to eat while having a fascinating debate about the role of education, either in promoting tolerance or in promoting hatred, I really like the way the question has been phrased. I'm Marie McAndrew. I'm the chair in Canada Research Chair on Education and Ethnic Relations at the University of Montreal, also the co-chair of the Center for Ethnic Studies. So we're very delighted to be here, and because what we do is directly in that field, for more from a Quebec and Canadian perspective, but so it's going to be fascinating now to hear it from a more international perspective. As I said, we have a very interesting topic because I guess the three speakers will be able to address both successful example of how education can be used to improve tolerance and inter-ethnic relation, and I'm afraid to say so, probably a lot of instances in which it is being used to, if not promote hatred, at the least not to improve anything, especially as regards inequality and not only the promotion of tolerance. So we have a very diversified panel, which is very interesting. We have a person who is mainly, they're all thinker, but a person whose main activity is to be a member of parliament. I wouldn't say a politician, because let's say a member of parliament. I won't go in Afghanistan, and the youngest woman ever elected, the youngest woman ever elected to parliament, Mrs. Malaya Joya. I won't go too much in the bio. The bio are very impressive, but if we go to the bio, then we won't have any presentation. Then we turn into another type of opinion maker, a journalist and a writer, Dr. Akash Kapoor from India. He also is a thinker. He has done a lot of academic studies, but here he's here as a journalist, and he's going to reflect about the Indian situation, although maybe we'll discuss wider issue. Everybody is open to discuss wider issue than their own country, but the base of the presentation is probably the own country. And finally, we have the academia, represented by Professor Yossi Yona. He's from the Department of Education of Ben-Gurion University. Ben-Gurion University is one of the universities in Israel which has been the more active in looking at the issue of inter-community relation in the Israeli context, and his achievement in that level are also impressive, so I direct you to all the bio. And without losing more time, I will give them, each of them have been asked to speak 15 minutes. I will be giving a little leeway, but not too much, because I know that this audience is eager to discuss and interact with them. So, and we will follow the order that was proposed in the program. So, Mrs. Mrs. Joya, actually, I guess.
Yes.
Mrs. Joya, the floor is yours.
Good morning, everyone. Very nice to meet you all. At the beginning, again, let me thank supporters and friends of Miguel, who invited me in this event and gave me again a second time opportunity to talk about disaster situation of Afghanistan, especially about education, as education is a key toward emancipation, as I said yesterday as well. And I believe strongly in this. And I'm so honored that now I see myself on behalf of my people among teachers, professors, students, human rights activists, women rights activists, peace-loving activists of Canada. So we, as in this catastrophic situation, we really need their solidarity and support. As topic is today regarding education in our country, unfortunately, that those who are in power, they do not let that education improve, because our country has been occupied under the banner of women rights, human rights, democracy. So when we don't have freedom of our country, when our country has been occupied, so it means that we have nothing there. Why? Because there is a puppet, corrupt mafia regime is in power. Those who, first of all, they are misogynist, same like Taliban, most of them, those who are in power. And also they are against the education. That's why education didn't improve this 9 years after 9/11 in Afghanistan. And there our people face many problems. Now millions of Afghans, they suffer from injustice, insecurity, corruption, joblessness, poverty. Especially, we don't have security. For example, when some schools that they build, the girls want to go to schools or teachers, nobody guarantee their security. How much important, which is more important, I believe, than food and water even. And in some bigger schools, they build some schools. In some big cities, they build some schools, like in Kabul, in Herat, in Mazar-Sharif, also some universities. But in most of provinces of Afghanistan, in faraway provinces, even students, they are studying under tents with so many problems that they have there, and cold and hot weather. Which gives hopes. It shows that how much they have eager to education. But the problem is that in big cities that they build some schools and universities just because of the showcase of democracy, just to show through TVs to people around the world that we do good job, to justify their occupation, their war in Afghanistan, to deceive people around the world. That's the reason that in some big cities, some women and girls, they have access to job and education. Even in these big cities, they don't feel secure. They have security problem. And even the women, they didn't got the limited rights they enjoyed in centuries of 60s and 70s, while the U.S. and NATO, they shamelessly pretend themselves that we are the one who, first time we brought women rights, human rights in Afghanistan. Let me give you read you the report of New York Times, which published on November 8th of November 1959. The report is that Afghanistan women left the wheel. A new world of freedom, spiritual as well as territorial, has been opened to the women of this Muslim nation after centuries of seclusion. Only this report is enough to tell the big lie of the U.S. and NATO. And also this photo also enough that you see that here in 1967, the girls without a scarf, with modern clothes, even mini job, they walk on the streets and they go to school, enjoy their life, same like Western countries. But this 30 years war, the women and the girls, the children, they were the most and first victims. There's still many violences against them because of the warlords, because of the Taliban, because of the fundamentalists, that both of them are fundamentalists, that they are misogynist, first of all, and against the rule of the woman, this half of population of a country. Right now, for example, now not only we have some schools, some universities that government make, and also there is a lot of private schools, private university, that this is another new enemy of our people. As you, I think you agree with us, that privatization day by day make wider the gap between rich and poor, while most of people of Afghanistan, millions of Afghans, they don't have enough food to eat. So how they can go to these private schools with high salary? That good teachers, best teachers are going in these universities, but the level of the education in other schools and universities that some we have in Afghanistan, very, very low. That they have a lot of complaining, the students and also the teachers, when facing with lots of obstacles and problems. And while in some schools that they build, that the girls going to schools, they kidnap them, the warlords, local warlords, Taliban. They raped them, they threw acids on their faces. Maybe you heard in Kandahar, 15 girls going to school, they threw acids on their faces. But Karzai, this shameless puppet man, only after today that happened, yesterday through media, invite Mullah Omar, this terrorist man, to join the government. Put salt on the injured heart of our people. And also that acid they threw on the face of the woman, which happened in the past, that Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, this fascist man, threw the acids on the face of girls and women when they wanted to go to schools. Even those who are in power in faraway provinces, they cut the nose and ears of the women and teachers. And they burned the schools, some schools they built, and many, many other problems that they are facing regarding education. But they are so brave and do not stop it, which, as I said earlier, it is hope. And also that the government says 6 million girls and students going to school, while now even some other sources give report that millions cannot go. and hundreds of schools, even government itself gave report that the doors of closed, the doors of schools has been closed because of security. And they say Taliban because of the Taliban. They are not only Taliban. They are the local warlords and these other warlords who are in power, mentally same like Taliban, only physically has been changed. Let me give you one example. For example, Bashira, 16-year-old girl, she's going to school in Sarpol province. She has been kidnapped and has been brutally raped by three men, one of them son of the member of the parliament. His name is Haji Painda. He changed the age of her son less than 18 by document that do not be punished. After this rape case, six more rape cases happened in the same province because there is no justice, nobody asking about these crimes. And most of them, they are 14-year-old girls, 15-year-old girls, even 4-year-old baby, 40-year-old woman, that they brutally get raped by these warlords. And this awful population of our country, when they don't have education, how it is possible society improve? As always, I describe society is like a bird. One wing is man, one wing is woman. When one wing will be injured, how it is possible to improve? And these fundamentalists, warlords in Taliban, they are afraid from the role of the woman, from the education of the woman. For example, when they rape them, when they, were, for example, commit different kind of crimes against them, when they have education, they never kill themselves. As self-suicide increasing rapidly in Afghanistan because there is, as I said, that there is no justice, nobody listen there. Why some brave women and young girls that who are making case against these warlords, even they put them in the jail, they receive death threats, and many other problems that later I can share my own experience that as an activist that I have contact with these kind of women, that every one of them, they have suffered stories with lots of hopes. That they put progressive steps, and it shows that there's many hope that in the future, real democracy, women rights, human rights will come in our country. And also, not for example, drug. Drug is another big problem. As I said yesterday, they changed Afghanistan to the center of drug. Last week, before I came here, on TV, they showed a report that a young boy, he from the first class until 12th class that he finished, he was the he was first in his class with high numbers, very talented student. Hope you understand what I mean. And but now you know what happened because of poverty, he cannot continue the education. Now he used drug, and completely his life has been destroyed. See, many other talent we have in Afghanistan that they kill our talents, those who are in power. And the young generation, they go to the neighbor countries instead to go to universities to continue their education because of poverty. And also scholarship, a lot come to Afghanistan, but these warlords, those who belong to warlords, their relatives, they buy. And then it is chance for them more to come to the West to enjoy their life as well, and also to use from the high-level education of this country, and to be a spokesperson of these warriors as well. I cannot say all of them, but most of them that who are coming from Afghanistan for a scholarship, their background, when you see, they had link with these warriors. But for talented student, very, very less chance there, even not. And the money from the so-called international community under the name of education, reconstruction, etc., but most of money went into pocket of the warlords, drug lords, also these NGO lords. Our people put the name of these NGO like warlord, NGO lord, because most of money has been looted by Afghan and foreign NGOs. But some NGO that we there we have that really they are working and they are active, they are risking, the, accept the risk, but unfortunately even they are losing their project. For example, I was activist of organization of promoting Afghan women capabilities, OPAC, that I see that how much problem that they have. They have education and health project, even they had in the period of Taliban, some memory that I have, you can read even in my book. Anyway, but I see how much problem they face, like Hawkeye is another democratic organization. They lost their project and many other that we have. So, I know time is short. I try my best. I want to say that, regarding the NGO, some we have that really they are working, they have projects, but nobody support them. Let's support them. Give the money at least to this kind, to the honest hand to use it for the people, especially regarding the education. And here, the another key of the point of the topic that today we are talking was, it depends to the topic that the problem that our people has is dirty policy of British in the past that they played in Afghanistan, divide and rule. It's still that they are playing this policy, and they are, for example, regarding the election, if they had education, for example, for the some people they has been deceived, for example, it's because this is Hazara that they vote, another one because Uzbek like this. If they had education, it was not important for them, for some of them, those who attend, while millions did not attend in the election. But it's also, it depends to the education. If they had education, they didn't even, Taliban even misused from this opportunity that they deceive some people. They go with the people, some of them go with Taliban to take their revenge from the warlord, from this puppet regime of Hamid Karzai. If they had education, they never has been deceived. And I have a lot, I'm in a hurry, and I have only short time. Let me tell you another point briefly that regarding internet. Today, the world is very small, like a village, and how much you know internet is useful. But in our country, you see that not only that they don't have access to internet, even they don't have access to schools that how to write and read. You should have some project for some democratic NGOs that to give money regarding the internet to improve for especially young generation. So at the end, let me conclude that today's speech with solution. What's the solution? Again, I say as long as the warlords in power and these drug lords now negotiating with Taliban and these occupation forces will be in Afghanistan, there is no hope positive changes come soon in Afghanistan. But the only alternative who are able to fight against terrorism, fundamentalists, and who are able to improve the education system in Afghanistan, they are Democrats in Afghanistan who are right now, they don't have honorable job. And many rest they accept. Let's support them. There is a lot. I'm only one of those who I'm in front of you. I can introduce them to you and to be in contact with them, see their project, and help them for the bright future of Afghanistan. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Joya. I'm sure there are going to be many questions and reactions. I will now ask Dr. Kapoor to speak for 15-ish minutes.
Hi, everyone. I want to start by saying I'm honored to be here, and I want to thank the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism. I also want to thank the Eckenberg family for making this possible. As I said, I'm honored to be here, and I'm especially honored to be sharing a stage with people who I think have thought about these issues and who have more experience in education than I do. You know, I'm a journalist. There's a saying about journalists. I don't know if you know it. They say that we know a little bit about a lot of things and a lot about nothing. So I should say at the outset that I have written on issues related to tolerance in India. And I should also say that although my host didn't know this, I've also worked as a teacher for the last 6 years, teaching a course in literature to 15 and 16-year-olds in India. So while I'll be primarily talking as an observer, as a journalist, in the second half in particular of my remarks, I will also be talking from my experience directly as a teacher. Let me start with an overview about issues related to tolerance and education in India. And these have mainly played out in controversies over the contents of textbooks in the classrooms, and in particular, history and social studies textbooks. These controversies have periodically risen to the fore since independence, but they really came to prominence about 8 years ago when a coalition government came to power that was headed by the Hindu nationalist BJP, or Bharatiya Janata Party. At the time, the government was accused of doctoring textbooks, and again, particularly history textbooks, produced by the National Council of Educational Research and Training, and they were accused of doctoring those to reflect a pro-Hindu and anti-Muslim agenda. It should be said, to be fair and to present both points of view, that the government's argument at the time was that the content of the textbooks and education had long been dominated by leftists, with Marxist ideology, and that they presented a version of history that was bereft of religion, anti-Hindu, and favorable to Muslims. I'm not going to get into the merits or demerits of these arguments here. The basic point is that there were many groups and individuals who argued that the version of history being taught in India post-independence essentially imposed a secular, non-religious, and even anti-religious view on a nation that had religion deeply woven into the fabric of its identity. But what's really important to understand about these debates is that they were not obviously debates just over the contents of textbooks and classrooms. They were really reflections of wider debates about the meaning and definition of the Indian nation state, and in particular the role that religion plays in that state. So, you know, these debates have existed since independence and indeed before independence, and they include questions over the proper place of religion and especially Hinduism in a multi-religious society, the relationship between religious minorities and majorities, and the interaction between private faith and public secularism. It was actually the fact that these debates touched upon so many larger issues that they really were debates over the very idea of India rather than just over textbooks that I think accounted for why the textbook controversy and the debate over the textbooks at times became very passionate and fiery. Indeed, when you know, looking back now and reading over some of these debates, it's striking at times how they seem to center on seemingly small or pretty innocuous matters. For example, there was a very heated debate, and one of the most contentious passages was over a line in the history textbook that argued that in ancient India, beef was commonly eaten. It was just a small line in the textbook, but it was a statement that obviously was considered highly offensive to many traditional Hindus. Some of the most important debates centered around the way the textbooks treated critical periods in Indian history, especially the time of the Mughal rule, roughly from the 16th to the 19th century, and the subcontinental partition post-independence in 1947. Partition in particular was a very contentious topic, and the debates over partition centered over, you know, how blame was apportioned for the partition. Did the textbooks make clear that the pain of partition was shared on both sides of the border, that massacres were committed by both Hindus and Muslims? These are still very painful issues in India, and indeed in Pakistan and Bangladesh as well. And, you know, you need to realize that many students going to class would have had parents who may have lost a parent, a grandparent, an uncle, an aunt during partition. So, you know, how the story of partition was told was, again, not just a matter of a textbook. It really touched on core issues related to national identity and the formation of the nation state. So it should be said that some of these debates have died down a little bit in recent years. They really peaked at the sort of start and middle of this decade. There's a new group that's been constituted, and they've generally received praise for including a wider variety of voices in the textbooks. For example, in preparation for this conference, I went and actually downloaded the 12th standard history textbook that's used, and that's actually available on the internet, which in itself is impressive. And I looked in particular at the chapter on partition, and it was very impressive to see that it included a wide variety of voices. In particular, I was impressed to see that there were three narrative sort of life stories told by Pakistanis. They'd actually interviewed Pakistanis and gotten their perspective on partition. And so, you know, overall it was obvious that the textbooks were making a real and a strong effort to break down stereotypes, to bring in more voices. And it was quite impressive, as I said. That's not to say that these underlying tensions have disappeared, or even that the debates over the identity of India and what people in India call the idea of India has dissipated. I mean, they surface regularly in various spheres of life, everything from cricket matches to foreign policy to indeed education. You know, one teacher I was talking to recently told me that one of the hardest parts of her jobs is finding a way to navigate religious differences and tensions within the classroom. So there's still very much issues and debates. But I think it's fair to say that one positive thing that came out of the textbook debate was to draw attention to the issue and to draw greater attention to the issue, the fact that education and that the content of textbooks has a deep relationship to larger communal interreligious tensions in India. I think it's fair to say that it really woke people up. It revealed to politicians and to activists the powerful role that education can play and does play in either soothing tensions or inflaming tensions between different religious and ethnic groups. One thing that I have observed, and I do think this is partly a result of this controversy and a positive reaction to the controversy, is that the last few years have seen many more groups, civil society groups in particular, working in this field. that there's much more effort to work within the classroom. There's recognition that the classroom, like other institutions like the army, for example, really represents a locus of intersection for the great diversity and multiculturalism of India, and that therefore it's important to work within the classroom. Students in India come to the classroom with great direct experience of diversity, and sometimes I've heard people make the argument that therefore you don't need to actually focus on diversity or fostering tolerance in India because you have the urban atmosphere as the classroom. But obviously it's important to realize that experience of diversity doesn't necessarily translate into tolerance, and a lot of students do come to the classroom with great prejudice. So I think what education can provide really is a framework for approaching that diversity, for approaching the diversity that students encounter in their daily lives. The philosopher Michael Walzer has written that education teaches what he calls, quote-unquote, a regime of toleration. And this regime of toleration, this framework, obviously varies from country to country, but the important point is that it sets the ground rules for how a society accommodates diversity, how it deals with its minorities, and that these ground rules are really indoctrinated, if you will, although that's a bit of a strong word, but that they're set in the classroom. Now, I've spoken to many educators and activists and seen the types of steps that they're taking to foster greater tolerance in the classroom. They play games, they do role-playing, they read specific texts, a whole range of techniques. One teacher I was telling me about, she was telling me that she runs an exchange program with students between India and Pakistan, and she plays a game she calls Pick the Pakistani in class. And what she does though, she lines up Indian and Pakistani students against a wall, and then she asks students from another classroom to come in and ask them to pick the Pakistani, which of course they can't do because we're indistinguishable, right? Basically, and she said that this has a huge, powerful effect because it impacts the students, it humanizes the other, and it brings home the message that, as she says, they are just like us. Basically. So as I said, I've heard many such stories about specific interventions aimed at fostering tolerance. I think that these are obviously valuable. They're increasing in number and they're helpful. But what I want to talk about here, in the remainder of my time, and I think I have a little bit of time left, is not to talk so much about these specific interventions, because while I think they're useful, I want to suggest that specific interventions may not be enough, and indeed that they may not even be the most effective method for fostering tolerance. What I've seen both in my role as a teacher and in talking to other people is that often you need interventions of a more general order, interventions that are aimed at cultivating a certain sensibility or personality in the students rather than necessarily the specific virtue of tolerance. Again, I'm talking now in this part, I'm talking partly as a teacher as well. What I've seen in my class, I have a very diverse class, students who come from different socioeconomic backgrounds, different religious backgrounds, and because I have a lot of children of expatriates, also many national backgrounds. And what I've consistently found in the classroom is that tolerance is not an isolated virtue. It's rarely a matter of just teaching children to be tolerant towards others who are different to them. Usually I've found tolerance is part of a more general set of values and virtues, and the tolerance tends to come along with things like empathy, sympathy, compassion, especially for the less privileged, and just a general state of mind that we might call consciousness or conscientiousness. Broadly speaking, as I said, I teach a literature class, and I would say that tolerance is part of a general set of humanistic values. And I've often found that children who are the most tolerant in class, who are most comfortable with difference, if you will, are also students who tend to possess these wider sets of values more generally. Just to give you an example, a couple of years ago we were reading an essay by James Baldwin in class. We were reading The Fire Next Time. I don't know how many of you know it. It's a brilliant essay. And the discussion turned to the plight of African Americans and social prejudice. And the discussion turned to questions of, whether individuals in the essay should assume greater responsibility and agency. The debate, it's a common debate in the U.S., maybe in Canada too, not so common in India. But anyway, what fascinated me was to see the reaction of my children in the class to this debate. And I found a pretty clear split down the class. The children who sympathized with the African Americans in the essay, who understood the larger context of poverty, were children who didn't sort of like blame them for their poverty and their privilege, were often the ones who had other character traits, like a willingness to listen, an ability to have their opinions challenged in class, to rethink their assumptions, and just a general eagerness to be curious about the world and about other people in the class. Interestingly, I also found, just as a sort of a personal observation, I found that children who were the most tolerant were also the ones who were most able to appreciate literature in a way, who related the most to literature. I'm not saying that, you know, only people who love literature can be tolerant, although I think there's something to be said for, I think, for the ability to respond. If you're able to respond and empathize with a fictional character, it perhaps suggests complexity. An ability to respond to a non-fictional character, if you will, as well. But anyway, so, you know, more generally what I'm suggesting is that tolerance is often part and parcel of a general set of humanistic values, and that the willingness to tolerate and accept and even embrace difference often comes with the ability to show empathy, sympathy, and to have a worldview that accepts and is curious about difference. This is not particular to India, of course. I think, you know, this is true across the board, and I've talked to educators from around the world who've told me similar things. But I think that, you know, what I want to end with talking about is that one reason why it's very important in India is because over the last 20 years or so, as India's economy has developed rapidly, we've seen a change in the nature of education and the educational goals of students. In particular, there's been a shift towards more technical and more business degrees in India, and a shift away from the humanities. So in an article I recently wrote, I analyzed some World Bank data on education, and I found that in the first half of this decade, so roughly between 2000 and 2005, the number of students seeking technical degrees grew 6 times faster than those seeking general humanistic degrees in the country. Now, this is probably understandable because India's boom has been largely driven by its technology and software industries, and it's those industries that have really captured the national imagination, that have given the nation a new sense of self-confidence and status on the world stage. So, you know, given that, it's probably unsurprising that there's an emphasis in the country on what, Martha Nussbaum calls education for economic growth, which is an emphasis on learning practical, marketable skills, a focus on immediate payback, and really a kind of return on investment measurement of education. This focus, I think, has come at the expense of the humanities, of literature, of philosophy, to some extent history and the social studies. And, you know, this is obviously a wider topic than I can get into here, but I just want to end by suggesting that if I'm right that tolerance is part of a more general set of humanistic values, then the focus on education for economic growth could prove highly problematic and even dangerous for the country in the long run. And by undermining the humanities, we may be undermining our capacity to cope with internal diversity and difference. It doesn't have to be that way. We all know about the wealth of Indian literature, both modern and ancient. Scholars like Amartya Sen have repeatedly pointed out that India has a rich ancient tradition of literature, philosophy, intellectual inquiry.
I'm talking about the role of education, Israel, public education, vis-a-vis the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And more specifically, the topic would be between compliance and resistance, which means to what extent can public education can resist and to what extent it actually complies with government's policies. And, of course, my conclusion is that it is plays more compliant role than a resisting role. I would like to do that, you know, with relation to 3 factors, sort of put things in context. First is the political zeitgeist dominating Israeli society nowadays, and then with relation to the political structure, the basic political structure of Israel, and then vis-a-vis the peace talks, some historical moments, you know, that were important against which to examine the role of education. and brief to say that when there were peace talks and there were some hope, then we could see that the public education has been sort of recruited, maybe willingly, to promote ethos of tolerance and peace and so forth. But when there are no peace talks, when the government is, let's put it this way, adopting, I would say, narrow-minded national policies, then education follows suit. And I want to begin with some examples of actually the last few months in Israeli society vis-a-vis the situation of education. 3 weeks ago, on the 20th of September, the Daily Haaretz reported that the head of the pedagogical secretary in the Ministry of Education decided to cut earmarked budget to citizenship education and to rechannel the money to programs promoting Jewish heritage and history. 2 weeks ago, on the 27th of September, Haaretz also informed its readers that, and I quote, the Ministry of Education ordered to stop teaching the Arab version of the conflict alongside the Zionist one. This version of the conflict appeared in a book titled, and I quote, to teach the historical narrative of the other, Israelis and Palestinians, end of quote. The book is banned, and this is not the first time. Last year, the book titled Nationality, Building a State in the Middle East, was also banned. The reason? It recounts the Palestinian refugee problem of a Palestinian, from a Palestinian point of view. And during the last month, the head of the pedagogical secretary decided to shelve yet another book titled To Be Citizen and in the State of Israel. The reason? The book includes the awful assertion, and I quote, since its inception, the State of Israel carried out discriminatory policies against the Arab citizens. So this is no longer allowed to be mentioned in Israeli books. Now, actually, these acts of censorship receive now the seal of the legislature. The Israeli parliament passed a law last March banning activities commemorating the Palestinian Nakba on the Israel's Independence Day. Now, these developments actually reflect a culmination of systematic and orchestrated efforts made recently to infuse school climate with national values. The aim, as the head of the pedagogical secretariat bluntly put it, and I quote, to strengthen national patriotism. And as part of the efforts to achieve this goal, children are now required to sing the anthem at the beginning of the school day, and army officers instruct teachers how to promote motivation of youngsters to serve in the army. Many other initiatives we are promising are on the way. And if not, this is not enough, we also see some voluntary organizations today, you know, sort of springing in Israel, accusing the academia and NGOs of showing anti, and I quote, anti-Zionist sentiments or biases and things like that. And there's also the emergence of a new phenomenon. Just imagine, university syllabuses are circulated and minutely scrutinized in daily newspapers. One may think halcyon days, an intellectual renaissance is sweeping throughout Israeli society. Well, this is not the case, unfortunately. What we actually see are prominent columnists, self-appointed censors, conducting witch hunting, embarking upon a holy mission to uncover traitors in the academia. And some academics themselves jumped on this eerie wagon. Haifa University held an academic conference in June of this year devoted to the subject New Anti-Semitism. Special attention was given to manifestations of anti-Semitism within the Israeli left. The latter, the Israeli left, consists of course, of self-hating Jews. Probably I'm one of them. And now we've got to understand, I mean, this sort of atmosphere in Israeli society actually has to do with or to put it differently, we have to understand this ethos against a very familiar distinction with respect to nationalism. And what I have in mind is the distinction between ethnic versus civic nationalism. Now, Israel is ethnic nationalism. It's ethno-national state. And as Roger Brubaker, sociologist of nationalism, says that ethno-nationalism lives constantly under the fear of extinction, under the fear of being taken over by the minority living within the state. In that case, would be the Palestinians. And many of its policies, and of course its ethos, it's engendered or generated by this sort of constant fear of annihilation. And of course, now this fear would be inconsistent, of course, with, say, if you wish, the commercial, economic, political, and military balance of power. But of course that Israel has the upper hand in that respect. But that nonetheless does not actually cancel out or counterbalance the basic existential fear that is dominating Israeli society. And this actually is manifested also vis-a-vis the role of education, because ethno-nationalism usually views national conflict as a zero-sum game. This is the way ethno-nationalism views the conflict. And I want to give you an example to show how deeply seated this sense of a zero-sum game. Reuven Rivlin, who is currently the chairperson of the Israeli parliament, gave a succinct expression to the assumption that we're talking here about zero-sum game. Following a modest initiative of the Minister of Education in the year 2000 to include poems of Mahmoud Darwish, the Palestinian national poet, in Israeli school curriculum, he said, "If we allow the teaching of a Palestinian national poet who denies our right for self-determination, we actually renounce any claim to moral justice. If we allow this, we actually instill in our children the thought that maybe Zionist movement was not a moral movement after all." And he continued to ask sarcastically, "Maybe there is no justice in the wish of the Jewish people to return to their homeland after 20,000 years of exile. Maybe we should get out of here." End of quote. The poet Aaron Amir, Israel Prize laureate, expressed a similar opinion. And he says, "Before we are completely swept away to the shore of the other, we should first be sure of our own identity. We should remember the dictum of our sages: he who hears many voices will never hear his own voice." Multiculturalism was not his favorite ideology, of course. Now, although indicating a firm feature of the basic structure of Israel, of the Israeli political system, ethno-nationalism is negotiable, I would like to claim. It is malleable. And it changes vis-a-vis the peace process. I mean, whether there is a peace process, then you can see, I mean, whether there is a hope for peace, that you can see the malleability of ethno-nationalism in Israel. And that happened twice. It happened in 1994, following the Oslo agreements, and it happened again when Ehud Barak was the prime minister and began the peace talks with Palestinians under the auspices of the Clinton administration. And you have to remember that what I just quoted before by the politician and the poet were actually during this epoch, right? Was this epoch. I mean, they were concerned, you know. It means that the time when the peace process were going on, right, they were in a way objecting that, well, maybe the leftist government is running too far and accommodating the Palestinians and so forth and so on. But unfortunately, circumstances have changed since then very, very radically in Israel. It seems that the sway of the pendulum, you know, goes to the right wing now. And this is what explains what I said before, you know, the ethos dominating Israeli society today. And the situation today is the following. Besides the fact that we have a Likud-led government coalition enjoying the support of the Labour Party headed by Barak, this government, I would dare say, either is not willing to pay the price for peace, and it does not believe that there is a real Palestinian partner to peace. And this is actually the legacy of Ehud Barak following the failure of the Camp David talks. And the Israeli public today actually buying in into this ethos. There is no Palestinian partner to peace. I mean, this is really like, as a matter of fact, I would like even to say that the political issue vis-a-vis the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to a certain extent, is not an issue. I don't know if you read the Time magazine report 2 weeks ago. Like, most Israelis have sort of went to some kind of escapism. I live in Tel Aviv. Like, from Tel Aviv to the West Bank, it would be 25, 30 minutes. When you talk to people in Tel Aviv about the West Bank, they would think that you're talking about some far remote province of the Roman Empire, you know, somewhere in Judea. It's over there, you know, far away. Nobody wants to hear about it. Actually, nobody wants to hear about it. They say, where is it? You know. So, and that is to be explained by the fact that on the one hand, you know, I mean, they don't believe that something can be done. And so they don't want to be involved in it, of saying, okay, you know, nothing gives. Nothing gives. So just leave the day. You know. And so they're not very much concerned about politics. It's very interesting because on the one hand, it's a very acute national conflict. On the other hand, you see some kind of indifference, total indifference, vis-a-vis the Israeli public. So it is in this context that we have to understand the role of public education. Just, you know, a small quote. I teach the university course about multiculturalism and education. And a school teacher, a principal wrote me a paper. It doesn't really matter what the subject. But preparing this lecture, it caught my eye, you know, what she wrote there. And it tells everything. She said, she wrote like that, "We see ourselves as the emissaries of the state of Israel. We see ourselves as the emissaries of the state of Israel." Yeah. This is our role. So and this would be, I think, the rule of the land. You know, the most schools look at it this way. So, but I want to say something in a way of hope. Very limited, you know. Very limited.
So then you'll get your 2 extra minutes.
Okay. Because of that. And this hope springs from a paradoxical fact. At the time of the Oslo Agreement, the Labour-led government tried to bring in into the public education is talk about peace, reconciliation, and mutual accommodation between Palestinians and the Jews. Now, religious Zionist schools objecting to the Oslo Agreement were able to show tacit resistance to this agenda. So this is, in a way, it's an opening for hope, which means that if the religious Zionist can resist that, so today we can think about it a similar way, that the secular or left-wing schools might be able, of course, to display some kind of resistance. And I think Akash talked about that, about civil society organizations that are being involved in education. Of course, we see that. So in that sense, I'm saying it is very limited optimism or very limited hope. So it would be some kind of a bottom-up. There is some place for bottom-up education for peace, but it would not. But it would not be very much effective. But that takes me back to what I said before. School is submissive agent of government. School is submissive agent of the hegemonic worldviews, of the public mood. It cannot and never, and you cannot bring any example in human history that education were able to work opposite to the policies of the government. It can do that only on the margin. So to conclude my talk about that, I say, because I'm involved very much in this kind of project, so I say when I wake up in the morning as a humanist. I go and I try to change here and there. I go to sleep as a sociologist. I know the limits. And then I wake up in the morning and I forget about, you know, my insight of last night. And I go again and try to do it. And then you go on this kind of rotation between hope and pessimism.
Thank you very much. So we had three very interesting papers. I say we had one presentation on extreme inequality of access to education, and two presentations more on the role of formal socialization and its relation to nation building. A few thoughts I'd like to share with you. First, I was wondering if we didn't pay too much attention to formal socialization, especially textbooks and history textbooks. These are a very heated controversy in Canada, in Quebec. But do education really is centered around formal socialization? I was also wondering to make a link between what Joya presented and Mr. Kapoor presented. This is Joya, Mr. Kapoor. How relevant are those controversy in a country where the majority of students don't even have access to secondary education? These are typical controversy of high school, secondary education. What do we do about gross inequalities in education? I think in Canada we tend to do exactly the same. We have an enormous debate about reasonable accommodation, history teaching, while we're not looking so much at the native people, non-access to education or the failure of black youth, for example. So I think one main question I'd like to raise is what is the more important in promoting tolerant society? Is it the equalization function of education or is it its socialization function? I know it's not a yes or no, but I think we have to put a balance between. Second thing, I was very interested by Jonah's presentation. When we receive an Israeli speaker, we usually think we're going to hear more about the structural aspect and the contact aspect. Nobody in education discussed in the three presentation, because one of the classic thing is, are people school together? Because it's very nice to be in formal socialization, and Israel being one of the most dynamic society to try to put Palestinian and Jewish together and with some experimental school, I mean contact theory and peer of people. So I'd like to also feel a little bit what's the role of contact being schooled together as opposed as hearing about the other, which I think is also an issue in Canada. French and English, we never meet before university and not even sometime at universities, but we say nice things about each other in our curriculum. But is it really... So basically, role of contact and the equilibrium to be found between the role of schooling in equalizing access to education as opposed as, I would say, middle-class high school controversy about building, nation building, which usually don't touch necessarily people who don't have access to school by definition. My last little comment would also be just to make you a little bit more optimistic. I like your idea that, civic nationalism has to be opposed to ethnic nationalism, but you say you never met a school system that couldn't go against the dominant feature. I'd say I've never met a civic nationalism in my life. I'm 56 years old. So I think we wish we would find civic nationalism, but any nationalism is a mix of civic and nation, because a nation is never only built on the future. It's always built about shared memory, and by definition, shared memory has an ethno-national component. So I think in the U.S. you have debate about the role of history, and whether you call it civic, like in France, laïcité can be very ethnic too. So I think we should be a little bit more cautious. And last little comment also, maybe. I was very glad you finished by your pessimistic vision, but I'd like to hear the two other speakers. Are you that pessimistic about the autonomy of education? Because when I was a little younger, we used to speak about the new sociology of education as opposed to the old one. The old one was the black box, that education didn't do anything, it was just reproducing society. While the so-called new, which was not so new anymore because it was in the 70s, 80s, was the idea that we had to look at where was the margin where education could really make a chance. So it'd be interesting to know if the other speakers are so pessimistic about the fact that education follows basically the dominant rule. So I'm just maybe asking everybody if they want to come back on this, and then I'll give the floor. And so, for example, in Afghanistan, there's major inequality, but what would be the role of schooling in promoting tolerance? You spoke mostly about the inequality of access.
The government, you know, of course, that because education is very important key, as I said earlier, that the government, especially those who are fundamentalists, those who are misogynist, they are against education, improvement of education. Same in my country now. For example, in the dark period of Taliban, no need now to talk, and also dark period of these fundamentalists who were in power from 92 to 96. Before of Taliban, they committed many crimes, especially against education and women and girls, role of women and girls. But now, in these 9 years, completely they control the universities, some universities and schools that they built there, that we have. For example, the brave teachers and students that they are, they, of course, situation is political situation. Impossible that there, especially in university and school, that there is the place of intellectuals and also open-minded people, of course, that they discuss about some, every day is a shocking news and disasters, that they discuss about different issues that are happening every day in country. Another day in the morning when they are coming, gathering together, they discuss, or some newspaper that they have from the school, that they want to write the truth, but they do not let them. The government do not let them. Even in a school, in a university, sorry, in Kabul, a young boy has been killed by another fundamentalist young student by knife. And you know what happened? The boy, like magic, skipping the West. How it is possible? Nobody asked, and that boy has been victim. Just the reason why? Because against these fundamentalists. The journalist, for example, last year was bloody years for the journalists. The journalist just one single sentence say against the government, even do not wrote. It's very easy to kill them, as recently also one journalist in front of his house has been killed, shooted. And every journalist who has been killed, every teacher, every student, then they say, okay, we are searching. But the result, nobody find the result. Who did this? And the reason that they killed them is political reason, because situation is political, and when they raise their voice against these injustice, they do that. And also the books, when you see the in the schools that they teach, especially liberal school book, maybe you heard about. In some of these books, for example, they say one gun is equal to two gun. One gun plus two gun, I don't know, is equal to how much gun. One infidel, I don't know, kill two Muslim. Like this kind of question, you know, they just try to do brainwash. But anyway, which is clear in the university and the schools, nobody there to talk, to discuss political issues. Let me give you one memory that it will help more. That, for example, during the presidential election, of course, it was non-democratic. And I said in some of interviews, some foreign journalists coming, I am explaining about this election impossible to be democratic. But in a class, one of my supporters gave me this report. In a class, the teacher asking from the students, what do you think about the election? You know, nobody dare to tell their opinion. Only one student say that, yeah, I agree with a woman that who was in the parliament, but right now, and was saying that this election not democratic, and we agree. But do not dare to mention the name. You know, the teacher asking, why do you mention? You mean then the classmates next to her saying, you mean Malala? Say, no, I didn't say, you said. She's saying, why? Said, my father said, don't mention the name. It is too much risky for you. See, only one example I told you. Even in the classes and the university, and when they publicly they raise their voice, it's very easy. Tomorrow, next to their doors, next to their house, they come with gun and kill them.
Thank you. Any reaction before we give the floor? For example, if I ask Kapoor, I'm pretty aware about all the debate about history teaching in India. These are per nature debates surrounding students who get to secondary education. And those textbooks are mainly English language textbooks, so basically there are also people who go to those English medium schools. So it's a rather elite debate, although in India elite is a lot of people because you have a lot of people, so it makes a big debate in the newspaper. But how would you address more the role of education in India, let's say at the primary level, when we know that in some classrooms, some lower caste people are put in a little corner, that there is a lot of informal socialization and inequality happening, that the Muslims don't have access to education, that madrasa is often the only way to get primary education, even for some Hindu in some rural area. So I would like to ask you, how would you look at this issue more if you were to make a link with what Mrs. Joya just presented?
I mean, I guess I would say two things. The first is that, I mean, I agree with you that to some extent these are elite debates, although, of course, textbooks are used, you know, not only in English medium high schools or whatever, but to some extent it permeates into all the textbooks. You know, the other thing is that they are elite debates, but at the end of the day, the national imagination and a lot of the national discourse is shaped by the elite middle class through the media, through various other sort of public instruments, if you will. So while it may be focused on what's going on in upper middle class high schools or whatever, if you want, I think that the impact of the debate and stuff does permeate out into the wider society. The second thing is that, I mean, the socialization aspect is obviously very important. What happens outside the sort of formal textbook, and I referred to it, you know, that game of picking the Pakistani or whatever is obviously an example of that. And I think there's this general realization of that, a lot of it going on, and certainly the mere fact of interaction with other ethnic groups or whatever. Regardless of what they're reading in the textbook, can provide a certain framework, if you will, for toleration. I think that's.
Yeah. And you're an optimistic more than
no. Well, I'm optimistic. I think that the last point that I made about the decline of the humanities is worrisome, but it might just be a moment, you know. It might be a moment in the evolution of the country. Certainly, we've witnessed a kind of commercialization of public life over the last few years that's come with rapid development and new economic growth, and that's permeated not only in education but also in other vehicles like the media. But that commercialization might also be setting the foundations for a richer cultural life. One person, I was writing an article about this, and one person I interviewed put it very sort of well. He said, well, look at New York. New York is both Wall Street and it's the most vibrant publishing culture in the world. And so maybe you need that kind of financial base in order to cultivate a wider appreciation in humanities and things like that.
Thank you.
The situation in Israel is much more complicated. First, the population is very largely segregated. Arabs and Jews do not live in the same cities, in the same towns, in the same neighborhoods. So we have only five bilingual schools that are called like that. And what I mean by that, by bilingual, that they try, or at least they are based upon multicultural principles, saying that there is a room for both religions,
the historical narratives of Palestinians and Jews alike. Now, these five schools, now they are faltering because of the conflict becoming against intense. Otherwise, what you would have, and some, there are relatively mixed cities, maybe in Jaffa and Haifa and other places, where there is an encounter between Arab children and Arab Jews. But I want to remind you about this sort of encounter. They are not done on an equal ground, which means in a mixed city, which means that an Arab would assimilate to altogether within a Jewish school. There is no any formal arrangement or structure sort of securing by identity for Arabs and Jews in the same school. Only in these, as I said before, and the five bilingual schools that are now very faltering, because my brother, for instance, he was sending his daughter to one of these schools. But the time of the Intifada, all the initial conflict erupted, and it was almost impossible, you know, to have them together, the Arab children and the Jewish children. So it became, as I said, it became sort of impossible, and it's faltering right now. So that adds up to my pessimism. Sorry.
Thank you very much. I will now ask if there's comments, questions. It can be either a question directed to somebody or comments about the discussion we're having. And maybe you can identify yourself for the...
Are the teachers diverse in terms of ethnicity, age, gender, class, political affiliation, etc.? And secondly, is there any role for parents or community in the educational process in an organization? Do they have much influence? Do they have any influence, etc.?
I will take three speakers and we'll go back with the panel. Do you have any problem with the mic?
No,
I was speaking to the girl. Are you? The mic is working? Okay, but we hear well.
Okay.
But speak loud. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Aditi. I'm from India. My question is actually directed to you, Akash. It was an interesting presentation for me, but I would want to draw your attention to the fact that when you talk of educators, you really mean teachers in formal schools, which would then imply for me that tolerance is a consequence of just an influence of education. Need to be true. And also, it's only now, in 2009, that we really have the right to education.
Exactly.
And a lot of children don't really go to formal schools.
Exactly.
Then how do we address the idea of tolerance? And would we say that children who don't go to formal schools or those who don't have access to formal schools would not be tolerant? And also, a lot of formal schools are RSS Shaka, that means they're Hindu fundraiser schools. They work on textbooks and non-textbooks, and it's a community way of teaching. That's not, for me, education would not be limited to textbooks and formal schools. But I just want to know your comments.
Thank you very much. I think there was two questions for the three speakers and a third one for you, Kapoor. Do you want to start? I don't know. Mrs. Joya? There was a question about the role of teacher and of parents in all those three school systems, I guess especially as regards tolerance, but in more general too, if you feel so.
Yeah, the role of parents and the role of society, of course, impact a lot on the mentality of the people. For example, now, as I said, that situation is political situation. It impacts a lot. Even the stone of Afghanistan, cat and dogs could speak politics. Could talk, they did politics. because the situation is disaster. So, it, for example, 30 years war that there was no school and people, this, we are living in the century of 21st and world is improving, of course, the impact on a country, backward country like Afghanistan. They really want, they have eager to education, they really want to, that their society will improve. And but unfortunately, the problem is, again, the system, this corrupt system that lots of money under the name of education receiving, but they do not use. And also, every teacher, each good teacher that they have even in the university, they have to do diplomacy, cover the truth with golden paper, that because otherwise it will be risky for them, even will face with the questions of the students. Parents, same. In the house, of course, they will, Democrat parents, educated parents, and especially situation is political. As I said, that this 30 years war, we almost lost everything, but we got one positive thing, which is political knowledge of the people. So even those parents not educated, but they know the values of the education, and they know these fundamentalists who are against education, they teach their daughters, their sons, to go to school and study hard. But again, it depends to the system, that the system is very bad system, very misogynist system against education, and they face many, many problems in the school. So just quite briefly, I said.
Role of teachers, parents, India, Israel.
I can. You want me to talk?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, I can address the question that I was asked specifically about India by saying, first of all, that obviously, and I tried to make that point, that civil society plays a huge role. It's not all formal education or classroom. And what I've seen that's interesting is the interactions between civil society and the classroom. And in fact, many teachers that I've spoken with are activists themselves. And so they're sort of like a cross between civil society activists and teachers. And obviously, you know, the media, other instruments for sort of public cohesion or whatever play a huge role. So by no means is tolerance only going to be fostered in the classroom. The other thing, and this partly addresses, you know, the gentleman's question about parents. Parents obviously play a huge role, and obviously that the family structures and so on play a huge role. Unfortunately, parents are not always the most tolerant, and they may be fostering some of the prejudices that students bring into classrooms. One interesting story I heard about recently was about tolerance percolating out of the classroom into the household. I'll try to keep the anecdote brief, but basically it was from the same teacher that was talking about this India-Pakistan exchange program she ran, and she talked about one parent who refused to send her child, I think it was a boy, to Pakistan because, you know, like, I don't want my boy going to Pakistan or whatever. So then the next time when the Pakistani students came to India, she made a point of having a Pakistani student stay at this children's house. And apparently that totally, the interaction between the parent and that student totally changed the woman's attitude, and the next time there was an exchange program, she was willing to send her child to Pakistan. So that's an interesting example of tolerance coming out of the classroom into wider society. Just one last point, again, to the gentleman's question on diversity of teachers. That's obviously the role the teachers play just in their sort of own social attitudes or whatever is hugely important. And one of the things that I didn't have time to talk about this morning, but, you know, these are not just about religion. Obviously, I focused on religion, but there's issues of tolerance between castes, between socioeconomic groups or whatever. And teachers play a huge role in fostering that kind of tolerance. I came across a story, or this is sort of a pessimistic story since we're talking about optimism and pessimism, but it was about a rural school, and an activist had been there doing some research, and what they saw is that the upper caste teachers refused to sit at mealtime with the lower caste teachers. And obviously you can imagine the kind of message that sends to the children, regardless of what they're going to read in their textbooks or be formally taught in the classroom. So obviously teachers play a huge role too.
A few points. Regarding the teachers, most of teacher colleges are run by the state, and so they're working within the state curriculum. So with the limited freedom that there is, it's that curriculum. Second, Jewish teachers teach usually, and the Jewish schools and Arab teachers teach and Arab schools. Not much mixing. Actually, there is a big problem in the Arab schools because there are too many teachers.
Because for many university graduates, Arab graduates from university, they are not able to make it into the job market, you know, and their own whatever specialties that they were gaining at the university, engineering, stuff like that, you know. So they would go to the public education, and so you have an overflow of teachers right there. And now, to say something in a sense, again, optimistic or positivistic about it. Paradoxically, the Israeli education system going through very strong reforms of decentralization and privatization, which means that the state is not able to regulate schools as it used to be in the past. Now, to what extent can schools and teachers can exploit the opportunities following these forms of decentralization and privatization? I think that there is a chance. I mean, there are some possibilities because of these paradoxical consequences. And I want to add to that, you know, the decentralization and privatization in Israel means growing scholastic gaps and real damage to the principle of equal opportunities. Yeah, that's on the one hand. But on the other hand, decentralization or decentralization and privatization do create some room for some independent, bottom-up initiatives encouraging some kind of tolerance and coexistence between Arab and Jews.
We had, I know it's a lot of people, but we had a question about secularism and its limits to accommodate religion. Maybe very quickly to anybody who would have to contribute to that, and then we'll go back to the...
I wanted to say something about that, you know. And what we see in Israel is the phenomenon of religion is actually intensifying, growing. Three factors. I may call them reborn Jews. A lot of secular Jews becoming religious. The birth rate of Jewish people is much higher than secular. So we see in the future, like about maybe 35 to 40% of the children enrolling in Israeli schools would be religious. Will be religious Jews. And third, there is an initiative by the Ministry of Education to increase Jewish education being fashioned as being defined as a cultural Jewish enrichment. So all these three factors, reborn Jews, birth rate, and increasing Jewish education seems to increase religiosity at the expense of secularism and Israel today.
I don't dare to ask you in 30 seconds to explain secularism and religion in the Indian system, but can you try at least 2 minutes?
What's the question?
The question was asked by somebody that we used to favor secularism, but is secularism the right answer now? Can it accommodate really religious preoccupation? And how do we balance secularism with growing religious preoccupation?
The question takes 30 seconds. So
I know.
I mean, first of all, there are obviously various definitions of secularism. You know, different nation states have different definitions of secularism. But I mean, to me, what I see in the textbooks, and I don't know if this is a definition of secularism, or you could maybe call it, you know, multicultural secularism, is a diversity of voices, and that you make, and that you're representing different voices there. So to me, that you're able to accommodate religion, you're accommodating the diversity of religion. I don't, obviously some states, you know, maybe the French state or whatever, have a definition of secularism that's more aggressively banishing religion from the school. I don't see that necessarily, that's not happening, and I don't see it being feasible in the Indian context. So I think it makes more sense to include as much of a diversity of voices as possible. That's my 30 seconds, so I'll cut my losses.
Anything to add on this?
Yeah, regarding secularism, let me say that in Afghanistan it's impossible that nobody to talk about secularism publicly. Those who are in power, because Islam is a very good tool in the hand of these extremist fundamentalists, these warlords for photocopy of the Taliban to mix with politics and use it against people, especially women, as a style they do, and the reason of the many violences against women that increasing rapidly, one main reason is that. I believe that if we had secular democrat government, today even Mullah Omar was in power, was not able to continue to his fascism under the name of Islam, religious. So there as even in some school, they say to the students, some fundamentalist teacher, secularism is equal to infidel, communist. Anyway, there are even, for example, how much they use Islam, for example, regarding, one example, let me give you regarding the scarf, that they every student and teacher must wear a scarf. Journalists and these other. They say if you not wear a scarf, it's like to be infidel. While in the past, in the century of 60s, 70s, I told you, women of Afghanistan, the students, the teachers, without a scarf, with open hair, with many job, modern clothes, they played their role. They walk on the streets. But this 30 years, because of these fundamentalist warlords, especially warlord in Taliban, they mix Islam with politics and use it against women in the school, in the university, in, when you have job in the office, everywhere. And those who happy with this and have high posts, they are assistants of Hamid Karzai, ministers, governors, commanders. So that's why we do struggle for this cause, and hopefully one day to come secular democrat government in power, then we will have everything. I think democracy without secularism incomplete.
We'll hear the last five questions or commentary, and then we'll again go back to the panel, and then we're told we have to eat. Excellent. Gender question. Next speaker. We all keep that in mind. Gender.
Focus on the Israel question. Find a lot of similarities to Quebec and Israel in terms of minorities and majorities and education an issue here as well. I understand that understanding the narrative of the other is still a very unsettled issue in Israel. But I'm curious in terms of the pendulum swinging back and forth, right to left, in Israel over the last 18 or so years, and its influence on education that you were discussing, the polling numbers in Israel that we see recurring show that general support for the idea of two states has been relatively consistent. The belief that it'll actually happen has decreased dramatically, but it stayed pretty consistent, and the influence, the change has been, in a sense, a reaction very often to security issues, terrorism waves, etc. So I'm wondering how you fit that into what you said. And I'm just a second small one is, since 1994 or so, the Palestinian education has been controlled by the Palestinian Authority for the most part. Can you comment on that? I mean, the topic is education as it relates to hate and prejudice on the Palestinians.
Thank you.
I want to address Governor Pender's question or comment about the role of education and equalization and the role of education and socialization. I do think that in India, as well as increasingly in the U.S. where I live and teach, there is a growing conviction that education must be a tool for economic growth to the exclusion of all else, because people need jobs, and you get jobs by getting vocational training, not by talking about ancient texts or American literature in the 19th century. And so resources are finite. You need to devote them to education for economic growth. So how do we balance that need for socialization with a balance for equalization? We can agree that both are important, but how do we build a case for balancing both and resources required?
So
Multi.
Thank you for an excellent panel. Shoya was the only person who brought up as a negative the issue of privatization of schools. We're seeing in England today an enormous upheaval with the privatization of schools. And now, as I do, before that the elite leads, that the elite sets standards and enriches the national imagination. But the problem with privatizing schools is an admission that we are not dealing with the less well-off society. We are not exploiting their potential in the positive sense of the word exploiting. And we are also neglecting issues like secularism, because a lot of private schools become denominational schools, because these have resources. The churches and the various religions have resources to organizational and financial to create the schools. I think it's extremely worrying, and one of the very worrying aspects of it is the gender issue, which I thank you before for bringing up, because in the story the authors have brought up the gender issue in education on the panel. So I the question really is about privatization, because Yana seems to see it as an opportunity. I see it as a threat, and I want to add one other thing, that in Israel we already have an enormous private system. It is denominational, it is the ultra-Orthodox, and to some extent the modern-Orthodox Jews who have most of the private schools. And the ultra-Orthodox have recently refused to have a core syllabus on mathematics, language, and human rights built into the school system, and they are subsidized by the state. So it's and I think it's not only the issue,
it's thank you very much. Last question or comment, then we will we'll hear your reaction. Can you get the mic a little down here? Yes. Thank you very much. I think most of the question can be addressed by everybody except some question where addressed to you. So Mrs. Joya, do you want to contribute to some of the question? I think the gender was addressed to you, and also the privatization of schooling was addressed to you. But if you want to, that will be your last chance to speak, so whatever you want to address for.
Yeah. Regarding privatization, I said earlier my opinion that only make wide the gap between rich and poor, but there could be two kind of private schools. One is the fundamentalist who make and pay for in the government, and another one is The government, I mean that those publicly they say we are not with government, but they receive money through, because have linked with these warlords and then pretend that I'm independent, like so-called independent parliamentarian inside of the parliament of Afghanistan. They say we are independent, but they are not. Anyway, but because political reasons, they make private schools not good. Not only why the gap between rich and poor, in the meantime, they teach their fundamentalist mind to other. Some other private schools that some Democrat that they build, for example, they wish that to serve, to help the people, to improve the education. For example, let me give you, it depends to the NGOs, it belongs to the NGOs, let's to tell better, Democrat NGO. Some schools that they build, there, of course, I agree with you that because society of Afghanistan is a male domination society, patriarchal society that we have, but another problem is also this misogynist government. So they must teach about women rights, the role of the woman, human rights. Same like we had, I was activist of OPAC, I said earlier, Organization of Promoting Afghan Women Capabilities. Even since Taliban period, they had health and education activities. Especially education was in the Taliban period because there was not education. And still they have their project. And one of the main reason that they stopped their activities and was interesting for me that I stopped working with them was that regarding the women rights that they teach them. And especially some classes, they had literacy classes for the men, and that at night or during the day when they had no job, if they were free, they studied. Yeah, you are right. But the main problem, again, I tell you, more than patriarchal system is misogynist system. Patriarchal society is misogynist system. Why? They do not let that the country improve. For example, as activists later, I will give you some of my memories, experience that how it has positive impact, the role of Democrat, that when these men coming with a mentality like male domination, sorry for my poor English. So when we talk, discuss with them, it impact a lot for them. Totally, they change their mind against women, about women. So there's no chance for Democrat to improve their activities because this misogynist government.
Thank you. Dr. Kapoor, any comments on one or the other issue?
Just two things. One, very briefly on the privatization thing. I mean, very briefly, obviously commercialization of education that I was talking about is a huge problem in the context of privatization of education because the market responds to need. So that's a big thing. On the gender question, I'm glad it was brought up because I talked about religion and caste a little bit, but obviously gender is another major issue, and there's a lot of sort of role-playing or whatever that goes on in classrooms that I've seen. And obviously gender is important not only in its own right, but because a lot of development studies have shown that it has an educated woman has far wider spin-off benefits than an educated man. So children in a household where a woman is educated are much more, and particularly girl children, are much more likely to be educated themselves. Nutrition, all these kinds of things are sort of spin-off benefits. I actually wrote an article recently on this issue, which took a kind of maybe unpolitically correct or counterintuitive thing, which was to say that in my area around where I live, at least, and obviously it varies around the world, this is pretty widely recognized now, and what you see, in fact, is almost the reverse from where you see development agencies so intent and so aware of the fact that investing, if you will, in women has spin-off benefits and that men are problems and impediments often to development, that the men are actually complaining that they're being left out of the development process because all the, the NGOs don't want to work with men because they're pains. They complain, they drink. Banks won't give men microcredit loans. It's only the women getting loans. Post-tsunami, a lot of the reconstruction that happened in my area, they put the title deeds to the new houses in the name of the women. So, then you have men. I've had men complain to me. They say, in the old days, like if we had a fight, we could just kick her out of the house and send her back to her parents. Now they say, hey, it's our house. You get out. It's my house. So it's hard to feel bad, obviously, for somebody saying that to you. Part of the argument I was making in the article was that, look, if men are such a problem in development, which I think they are, then that actually suggests that resources should be directed at sorting out that problem rather than just avoiding the problem.
Thank you very much. And last but not least, you had a lot of questions about Israel.
Yeah. Well, as to the
Palestinian schools too.
As to the situation or the support for a two-state solution, indeed, there isn't much of a change in the Israeli public vis-à-vis this solution. The majority of Israelis accept the idea of an independent Palestinian state. But here comes the crux. At the same time, most of them do not believe that there is a partner to peace. No, so we are in this kind of a bind, you know. So then it becomes sort of, if you wish, a philosophical, hypothetical thing. It is not a political issue. It's like, yeah, I am for a two-state solution. But then again, what are you going to do about it? You know, you're going to fight for it? You're going to enlist yourself to some kind of activities promoting this solution? No, I'm going home, you know, doing nothing, you know. This is the sad thing, you know, about it. So there's no contradiction between the fact that there is support for two-state solutions, you know, and what I was saying before, because we are all living after the legacy left to us by Ehud Barak, and I think that he has done big damage to the peace process in Israel in the sense of convincing the Israeli public that there is no serious Palestinian partner to peace. So this is one issue. Another issue about economic growth and socialization. You know, the issue about economic growth all the time, you know, sort of bothers me. In Israel, economic growth, when you think about economic growth, think about the economic growth of the state or of society as if it is a factory. They don't think about equality. So in that sense, you know, socialization seems to work sort of in harmony with economic growth, because economic growth does not mean decreasing economic gaps. So actually it goes together. You know, what does it mean, socialization? We all read Bowles and Gintis. The socialization could be a very good, effective way to create a stratified society. You know, there's no contradiction between socialization and stratified, segregated society. So this is my sort of comment, and I hope that it's satisfactory in this respect, very briefly. Now, the thing about the things that Francis was saying. Look, what can I tell you? I'm trying to grab to something. So I'm fully aware that, you know, that many of these privatization initiatives or the privatization of Israeli public education works against democracy, works against high moral values and ideals. But at the end, I'm saying, well, this is the name of the game. You know, this is what's actually happening today in Israel. Very brute and aggressive reforms of decentralization and privatization that actually, you know, undermining the whole idea of equal opportunities in education. Yes, I'm bemoaning that. I'm lamenting this. But at the same time, I say, well, this is the game. This is what happens now. Is there a possibility for civil society, you know, to counterbalance the evils that is being promoted and conducted by my government? So I'm saying maybe there would be some kind of civil society initiatives, you know, and there are, by the way, just, you know, to finish this, because I am doing some research on that or directing a group of researchers on that, and we can see that sometimes you can see sort of unintended consequences of policy. Well, there is some kind of bottom-up fight taken by these or that schools, and so it is something that, I don't know, I want to embrace and hope that it will grow bigger, but as I said before about going to sleep, sociologist, you know, so.
So I want to thank, we had a wonderful panel, we had a very good audience, very dynamic. We would have needed 3 hours, but I hope it makes you feel continue to think about the issue, and have a good lunch.